Senate Bill 494, the senior judge's bill. The purpose of Senate Bill 494 being introduced by the Supreme Court, or the request of the Supreme Court, was that if this bill were enacted, it would save the administrator's office for the court some work in the appointment of retired judges to serve in a pro tem judge capacity. The main thing, senior judge under the terms of the bill would be a judge who had served at least 12 years and then retired from the bench, and he could sign one oath of office as a senior judge of the state of Oregon, file that with the Secretary of State, and then thereafter be in the office of senior judge and subject to appointment with his consent to the trial bench or to the bench of the court from which he resigned or retired. Meaning, if it was a circuit court, it would be a statewide circuit court, district court, statewide district court. And he could serve then upon the filing of this one oath of office for the rest of his life. And the appointment would merely be a one sheet of paper that the Chief Justice would sign and assign him to a court with a copy to the judge and a copy to that court. The other reason for the bill is to give some distinction to a retired judge serving as a pro tem, where he'd be given the title of senior judge, similar to the title that a retired federal judge has, as compared to being a pro tem, which is a practicing attorney who has never been on the bench. And it would just give the distinction and the title to the retired judge. Those are two purposes for the bill.
Does two things then. It makes one, instead of having multi appointments of the same man, you have one appointment that serves the rest of his life.
Yes.
And the other is the honor. Is that
right? And he wouldn't be a senior judge unless he requested it and signed this one up.
But it really doesn't give you any more judges because we've got none. No. You would still do this.
It would just speed up the paperwork. Now, every time a person is appointed, he must somehow get before a notary public and sign another oath. And one copy has to be sent to the Secretary of State, another copy to the court in which he's serving. If he's there for one day, he has to do a separate oath. If he's there for a month, he has to do a separate oath.
What about the salary?
Sometimes it takes a little time to get him to a notary public and get the oath filed before he actually sits on the case in some quick assignment.
What
so it does create a little administrative problem.
What about the salary? There's no change in the salary arrangement.
The language in this bill is taken right from the pro tem, present pro tem language. It would say that judge exactly the same as he receives now as a pro tem, with a condition in there that a retired judge cannot receive more than a certain amount, which is the current language of the law.
Further question. Under the retirement law, you have to serve 16 years, isn't that right?
16 years to, you have to serve at least 12 years and pay into the retirement system at least 16.
What would happen to these judges?
Well, this bill wouldn't affect their retirement benefits nor their retirement obligations. I chose the 12 years for the idea that to be receive the honor, so to speak, of being a senior judge, you should serve at least the minimum time that a judge has to serve to qualify. And under the law passed in the 1971 session, the term of office was changed from 16 to 12 years on the bench. But the judge who retires after 12 years must continue to pay for 4 years more in order to qualify for the benefit. I don't think this bill would affect him there. He still, if he retired after 12 years, would still have to pay 4 more years before he started drawing his retirement.
His per diem wouldn't count towards retirement? Would
not
there be a state contribution toward retirement on the basis of his per diem?
I think the per diem would be completely separate, and it's not service as a pro tem judge, or in this case as a senior judge, would have nothing to do with the retirement system. It wouldn't increase the benefits. I think you'd have to handle that separately.
If you're 65, would you get double pay?
No, because the statute provides that once he starts drawing retirement, then he cannot in any 1 year draw more when he's counting retirement and his per diem than the salary of a judge of that court.
Mr. Cummings, thank you.
He could draw his retirement and he would draw his per diem, but the total amount in a given calendar year could not exceed the salary of a judge of that court. That's the present law.
Further questions? Thank you.
Thank you.
Yeah.
I move that we pass out Senate Bill 494.
It's been moved that Senate Bill 494 be sent to the floor with a due pass recommendation. Discussion. Clerk, call the roll. Senator Keystone?
Aye.
Senator Ivers?
Aye.
Senator Hoyt?
Aye.
Madam Chairman?
Aye.
Senate Bill 443. Mr. Chamberlain.
Madam Chairman, I'm John Chamberlain, the state printer, and I've come to testify neither pro nor con for Senate Bill 443, but to simply point out the impact that the passage of this bill may have on the state printing plant as it relates to our ability to accomplish work for each legislative session. It's anticipated during the next biennium, at the rate of growth that the Supreme Court and the Court of Appeals are generating material, that the revenue through the state printing division will approximately $250,000. The impact would be the loss of approximately 6 positions within our plant. Currently, we must go out and recruit anywhere from 8 to 10 people just to handle legislative workload every 2 years. This will put an additional burden possibly on us to recruit an additional 6 people. Now, when I say that I was not here to oppose the measure, the reason for that is that I can well see why the court would find it advantageous to subscribe to a publication that is already being published and eliminating some overlapping of publications within the state for the judiciary system. It seems rather strange to have 2 different publications of the same material going to the legal profession. And so, with these comments, I did not originally intend to testify in front of this committee, but with these comments, I would ask any questions that might be asked.
The questions, Mr. Chamberlain, Senator Ivers.
If this were to pass, and I'll have to confess I'm not too familiar with it, but at the present time, is it possible that these reports could be printed outside the state?
You're talking about the physical possibilities, Madam
yes.
Chairman? Is it
mm-hmm.
Certainly they can be printed anywhere.
I mean, under the present laws.
No, not under the state printing law.
But if this were passed, then they could be farmed out to some out-of-state printer?
It could be, I assume. Whatever the Supreme Court would choose to do.
Well, a bill like this is in another committee. Is this a bill that takes the printing of these things away from you and puts them out in the private?
I would assume that's what would happen. I think the intention was that it would be there would be a contract entered into with West Publishing Company or some other publishing firm.
Now this is
further question. Senator Keystone.
Does this apply to the advance sheets as well?
Yes,
and the report, the bound report.
Yes, sir.
Senator Hoyt.
Well, I'm just trying to find a pertinent language that really does. What are the action words in here that make some change? I can't seem to find the words I'm looking for.
Section 1, where it says the Department of General Services shall print now. That's the existing law.
It says cause to print, it doesn't say print.
Well, John thought he'd respond to that. I think there are other sections.
I'm trying to find out in the bill what language says that there's going to be a change and who prints it.
The law in the bill, if the bill presently eliminates or amends that portion which says that the Department of General Services will cause to be printed
yes.
these reports.
Does the word cause mean you'll hire it done or do it yourself?
No, traditionally, Senator, this has been done in the state printing plant since the plant was established in 1910.
I understand that, sir, but I was just trying to figure out the word cause, as I see it, is an action. It doesn't mean that the guy has to do the printing himself.
No, this is true. This is very
so
true.
I just don't quite see what the language here means. Maybe somebody else is explaining that.
I believe the language, and I'm not a lawyer, excuse me for not being better prepared, but the intention is to give the Supreme Court the latitude to buy their reports and their advance sheets from wherever they choose without the requirement that they go through the Department of General Services. which in effect may or may not take it out of the state printing plant. We assume that it would be taken out if the intention is to go to a law publishing firm who already is duplicating the efforts of the state printed volume.
So the question,
your plant is the people who do the printing in the state printing plant or have a working agreement with the labor organization?
Yes, they do.
What's the lapse of time between the time that their opinions are rendered and the time they appear in advance sheet form?
We're producing advance sheets in 3 weeks from the time that the last opinion is rendered.
And what about the reports, bound reports?
The bound volumes, we do not publish bound volumes until we've reached 700 pages of material. This is set by statute. We must wait until we've accumulated, or the court has accumulated, 700 pages of printed material before we can publish a volume.
I mean, is there 700 pages in each bound volume?
There is in the state volumes, yes.
And these are printed by other printing outfits have fewer pages, and that's why we're able to get them out sooner?
This is partially true. They changed their format. They are completely different format than what is used in the Oregon report. They're about 400, 500 pages. Different size books. They publish advance sheets also. They publish them, the 11 western states are combined in an advance sheet. They get their advance sheets out, I believe, about a week later than we do. But their reports come out much earlier. Now the feeling, as I understand it, I'm probably not too familiar with this, but it seems that the feeling is that the overlapping of printing similar materials is the reason for the spill to be.
That's true.
Send a burn.
But the private company just got into the sea recently, the last 2-3 years. No, I mean into the printing of the Oregon volume.
I can't testify to that. I'm not sure.
Is there any way that the legislature... Oh, is it more economical in the long run to produce the 700 pages than it is to produce lesser pages for volume?
No, I wouldn't say so. No.
Then if the legislature didn't require you to wait till you had 700 pages, but said 500 pages or 400 pages, then you get the bound volumes out sooner?
Well, I think that there's any number of things that could be changed to help us. That would be one of them. I think the combining of the Oregon appeals decisions with the Oregon report or the Supreme Court decisions would help us rather than publishing two distinct volumes. Excuse me, changing the format would help us some. Other things that have to do with editorial decisions I wouldn't be qualified to speak to. But
the format set by statute, too?
No, sir, I don't believe so.
Is it directed by the Supreme Court?
I beg your pardon?
Is it directed by the Supreme Court? Set forth a court of appeals separately from the Supreme Court?
Yes, this came from the Supreme Court.
Why can't you make the advance sheet citation correspond to the bond volume?
This is a decision pretty much of the Supreme Court. It also relates to the key system, and I don't understand the full intricacies of this, but this relates to the key system that is patented or copyrighted by West Publishing Company. They are able to do this for some reason. We are not.
Good question.
Excuse me, Madam Chairman. Please understand, I'm here in the role of a printer, not a publisher, so I cannot answer the question specifically that you've asked.
Thank you, Mr. Chamberlain. Judge Hicks?
I'm Lauren Hicks, State Court Administrator, appearing in favor of Senate Bill 443, which was introduced at the request of the Supreme Court. The purpose of the bill is to make it definite that the decision and discretion as to how the decisions of the Supreme Court and the Court of Appeals are published and distributed is left with the Supreme Court. The problem that the bill tries to address itself to and that we wish to, the reason we wish to have this latitude is, one, the time lag between the publication of a decision by the court, and by publication there I mean the making of the decision and releasing of it to the public and to the parties, and the time that the bound volumes are published and distributed to the bar and the public of the state, and also the cost in money, personnel, and space problem that we face in publishing and printing, distributing the bound volumes of the two courts and the Court of Appeals. Now, under the present system, we're getting the advance sheets into the mail almost exactly 3 weeks after the opinion is handed down by the court. We have in the past done as poorly as 4 or 5 weeks, but now, through good cooperation of my office and the state printer, we're very regularly getting the advance sheets out in 3 weeks. And I think that is about as good as we can do, and it's probably pretty good compared to around the country. On the matter of the bound volumes, however, those are not being put in the hands of the practicing attorneys, the judges, other people in the state who are interested in them until from 12 to 17 months following the last decision to appear in any one book. It has been 16 or 17 months in several cases, which is an awfully long time, and it means that people using these books have a tremendous number of advance sheets they have to look back to. We have worked very hard on this for the last year, again through the cooperation printer, and we've reduced it from to about 12 to 14 months. It varies a little bit with different cases depending on the burden of the printer and sometimes how quickly our proofreaders can get through the galleys and get them back to the printer. But generally speaking, it is taking now 12 to 14 months, and sometimes it goes up to 16 or 17. I doubt if we can get it much under 12 unless there's some radical change in the manner of presenting the material to the printer and just handling the format of it. The budget that we asked for this year for the printing or this biennium for the printing of these decisions was $322,268. Now the Ways and Means Committee reduced that budget by $66,536 with instructions to us to continue printing as we are for 1 year and then during the second year of the biennium to make some kind of a contract with the West Publishing Company. And on that basis, figuring that from some studies made that it would reduce our budget at least $66,000. That's the way the bill has gone out of the Ways and Means and now passed the floor of the House. Now, this does not really mean that the state would necessarily save the entire $66,000 because the sale of the books does bring back some money. And it appears that the saving in cash might be to the state of Oregon somewhere in the $40,000 to $50,000 bracket. It's a little bit hard to cost out exactly what it would be, and it would depend on whether those people in the printer's office left the state or whether they had other work to do. But at any rate, that is the action taken by the Ways and Means Committee and the House. Now, this bill does not necessarily say that West Publishing or any other private publisher will be the people to publish the opinions of the two courts. The Supreme Court acted upon this in a formal session, the seven justices concurring that the bill should be introduced to give the courts complete discretion as to how to publish their opinions and distribute them, and how to set the cost so that the cost would be realistic, that is, the price to the consumer would be realistic with the cost to the state. Because now we feel they are being sold at quite a lot. And that we could, in the next year, make a thorough study of what the alternatives are and how these decisions can be produced. Whether there should be a material change in the way they're handled with a state printer now, whether it should be a private printer in the state of Oregon, whether it should be a West Publishing Company or some other private publishing company. Among the western states that are now in the Pacific Reporter system, there are several of them that are, their opinions are published strictly by the West Publishing Company. Two of them, California and Washington, are published by other publishing companies. There's about three or four states that publish their own opinions as Oregon and Washington do. But we feel that we can't really make a study of this and get serious quotes from outside publishers particularly, unless it's clear that if the court decides to change the system from what it is now, that they would have that authority. Now, the justices were not convinced unanimously among themselves that changing the format from what it is now was the best thing to do, and several of them weren't sure that we should do away with the present Oregon reports and Court of Appeals reports and have only Oregon cases as our publication. Others of them feel that probably that is what we should do. But at any rate, this bill does not automatically cause that to happen. And it could, under the terms of this bill, go right on exactly as it is now. We do, I think all of you maybe know what these books are, but just in case anybody didn't, I brought along a sample of these. I don't have the advance sheets, but we're now publishing two, one for the Oregon Supreme Court and one for the Court of Appeals. And because the decision was made to have two books and two courts, it does take a little bit longer to accumulate the 700 pages, because you have to really get 1,400. And I think the reason for 700 would just be to give a similar size book and run the thing along in a uniform manner. Oregon Cases, published by our West Publishing Company, which would be one alternative, and probably the one that comes to mind first, is because they are in the business in the state. And they're publishing this book, which has exactly the same thing in one volume that we had in these two. But because of the prints and the way it's put together, they have more cases in one volume than we have in one volume. And the attorney can buy about four or five of these a year and have everything the two appellate courts have decided, right? It takes nine of these to have the same cases on your shelf. The cost at present prices is just about the same. The attorney at the end of the year will save just about as much money to have these on his shelf as you will to have the Oregon reports and Court of Appeals reports on the shelf. Again, the Ways and Means Committee was critical of the system because we're selling these Oregon reports at less than cost. The advance sheets under present law, which is statutory, cost $24 a year, and I believe the printer and my office worked out what they think is the cost of the advance sheets, somewhere in the $32 or $33 a year, actual cost to the state. Plus, of course, part of my staff has to mail them, keep the addresses up, and put them in mail bags, and so forth and so on. In the bond volumes, the Department of General Services sets the price, and they're now $7.50 for each volume, which the printer thinks is about his cost of producing the book. But there still is the storage of 35,000 some volumes in the Secretary of State's office as an inventory, tremendous amount of space taken up. We have one editor on my staff full-time, just handling the decisions. We probably would still have to have a half-time editor, even if it was published by an outside publisher. And there's all the mailing costs and keeping the sending out notices that they're ready and so forth. So there's quite a bit of coordination between the Secretary of State, the Supreme Court, and State Printer now, and each of them having some little part in producing these books. If West took it over, as an example, we would simply stop publishing, and the attorneys would start buying this book. It's published in Minnesota, and the advance sheet comes out in about 4 weeks, 5 weeks in some cases. It's like our advance sheet, except it does have the syllabus and the head notes. And the reason for the pagination being different, that one question you asked Senator Brown, was our volumes do not have the complete head notes when they go out in the advance sheet. Therefore, the pages in the advance sheet are never the same as they are in the bound volume. Whereas when West publishes their advance sheet, it's an exact publication, page by page, line by line, of what will be in the final volume. So the pagination is exactly the same. And one reason our printer takes longer is because he has to change the advance sheet print somewhat to make it fit into the bound volume, because we are adding things after the advance sheet goes out, citations and indexes and the head notes that go in the front of the page, and you never know whether it's going to be one page of head notes or two or three or four pages of head notes. So those are some of the main considerations we had in mind in attempting to get a bill that would permit us to really evaluate what the future of printing decisions should be.
I'd
like to ask about the cost. I understood to say that the West publication was the equivalent cost page for page or case for case as the Oregon cost. Is that correct?
The two costs of the advance sheet, our two costs, which are separated, mm-hmm. to the cost of subscribing to West Publishing, which includes the advance sheet and the volume. They sell their volumes for, I think, $17 per volume, which includes getting the advance sheet. We sell ours for $7.50 per volume, plus $24 for the advance sheet. When you add it all up, it costs an attorney from $80 to $100 a year, whichever service he subscribes.
How do you account for the fact that you're selling at a loss?
Well, for one thing, the you mean why we're selling at a loss?
Well, if the printer is not competitive, is that one of the problems?
Not sure how you mean that.
Well,
question.
You said you were selling these at less than cost to the lawyers of the state.
Because the only reason we're selling them less than cost is that the cost was set on the bound volume by the general services and on the advance sheets by the legislature, and it just now it's costing us more to publish than those two prices. That's the only reason the legislature could increase the cost to, or it should be for us, and the general services.
I'm not asking
a
question about it, Chairman. How does it happen that West is selling the same product to the rest of the media?
Well, are they making a profit, and you're not.
Efficiency, volume, production, I don't really know their cost. They're in the business, and they do it on a mass basis, of course. They publish books all over the United States. They're in they're turning to computers, incidentally, and they're now experimenting in computer printing in New York, and probably will be printing these books by computer in the near future. I think it just be their volume, whereas we're not really in the publication business.
Are you taking
account of the high cost?
In figure of cost, are you taking account of the free copies that your statute was
filed? Yes, yes, and if we did go to West, it would be they would furnish us the same list of volumes that we are now publishing at our cost, and they would charge us $16 a volume, and they throw in quite a few advance sheets to for us to use where people want advance sheets but don't need the volumes. But it's strictly just, I'd say, the volume, the fact they're in the business. That's the only reason. Frankly, they can't believe that our printer is publishing at the cost he is. I've talked to two of their people, and they just can't believe that the printer is publishing these books at $7.50. But his figures show that he is on the bound volume side, but the advance sheet costing more. And, of course, he has to divide how much he could have subscribed to the advance sheet and how much he could have subscribed to the bound volume. Incidentally, another place we're losing money in the state is that when we have to publish old volumes, and I personally think maybe there's some question whether we should be publishing reprints of the very old volumes, but every time the Secretary of State gets down to 10 or 15 or 20 copies of a certain volume, he reports to the Supreme Court, and the Supreme Court will go out and order through the printer a bid to how to replenish those with maybe 100 or 200 volumes. The last time we did that, the bid was $27.50 per volume, and yet we have to sell those books for $7.50. So we lose quite a bit every time we republish.
Senator Keith Burns.
Judge Dix, it's been suggested by some that one reason why the West prices are as they are, that they are competing with the state of Oregon. Therefore, they're meeting that basic price, and that if the state of Oregon gets out of the business, then they don't have competition, that the price may go up. Do you know anything about the history of other states where this occurred, and if that has occurred?
Yes. In talking to attorneys about, just to try to get their feeling of what they would think if the state wasn't putting out Oregon reports anymore, I found everyone I talked to has said, well, they didn't really care as long as they got a good volume at a reasonable price, and they would hope that if there was any change, that the state would keep control of the product and the pricing. So because of those inquiries, we asked West Publishing, for instance, which is the only publisher we dealt with to get comparison on private publishing. And they gave us figures that go back to 1921. They've had very few price increases in all that time, and they've had very few in recent times compared to the way prices are going up most places. I've also talked personally or corresponded with other states who are with West or Bancroft in private publishing, and none of them have had any problem whatever with the publishers taking advantage of being the sole publisher in the state. And I think you can rely on the past experience of the major publishing companies, and also just the plain integrity of the publisher. And they're in private business for a profit, obviously, but they also are rendering a public service throughout the United States, publishing law books of all kinds, and I think the reputation of any company that the Supreme Court would do business with would guarantee that. In fact, I really think if the legislature would raise the price of the advance sheet to where they probably should be, so there'd be a break even, that we might then be sending more attorneys into the West camp, because actually they're publishing at less. West would not tell us how many sets they're selling in Oregon today. They say that's one of the trade secrets. They've been very frank to answer every question we've asked except that one. We are selling about 600 and some volumes of every new volume that comes out. About 600 are purchased. And we have about 1,600 people buying, or 1,600 copies of advance sheets. Of course, over 300 of these to go to judges, attorneys, and district attorneys free. I think probably West Publishing is selling about the same number of volumes that we are, would be my guess.
Senator Friend.
Chase, what then if you did go to a private publisher, then probably they would be the same ones that would reproduce past volumes where you run out of it, right?
That would be a matter to negotiate. And in Indiana, West Publishing did go back into 1930s in republishing. Now, they wouldn't promise that they'd do that in Oregon. Indiana has a lot more attorneys, and maybe it wouldn't be feasible. I think probably that they would be generous in negotiating to go back and republish old volumes. They would do it as long as they felt that they could do so without losing money. We probably would have to continue to republish some of the older volumes, or just let them go out of print on the theory that there are quite a few available, and most lawyers have them close at hand, even if they're not in their office. Also, we're getting into the age of computers and photocopies, and there's methods being developed now and actually being sold right here in Oregon that by buying a machine of a couple thousand dollars, you can punch a button and have the page put on a viewer right in front of you and make a 5-cent copy immediately. And there's things like this that could take the place in the future, in the very near future, I think, of republishing entire editions of older volumes that are very little in demand.
Further questions? As I understand you, you have not attempted to make any arrangements with any district.
Absolutely not, and the Supreme Court, as I say, has not yet decided that they want to do that, and until the court decides that, we wouldn't make the next step. Probably what my office would do if this bill were to pass would be to make an extensive survey of just what are the alternatives, what are the cost factors, what are the time elements, and get something definite presented to the Supreme Court, and the court would then decide whether to continue as we are, change the format with the state printer, or go to West Publishing or some other publisher. I really, frankly, think it'd be West because they are in the state, but that's not necessarily the case.
If we were to pass this bill, one of us would have to carry it on the floor, and we wouldn't have to explain to the senators why it was necessary to pass. And as far as I've seen in what you said, is that you want to shop around. Why aren't you able to shop around as it is now? You don't have any concrete proposals. There isn't any particular thing you want, as far as I can see.
Well, mainly it's because we found in attempting to get information for ourselves and for the court, when we asked for it, the people who would give us this information say, well, it's too problematical. It'd be 2 years to get the bill through the legislature, and maybe it wouldn't pass, maybe it wouldn't pass, so things would change. They aren't very anxious to talk with us, because they don't think a decision could be made at the end of the talk. And that is the only reason we've come with this kind of a bill without more background. And we do have more than I've given you here in this verbal discussion.
We've
got several...
for this bill passing, one of us is going to have to carry it, and we have to stand there and face the questions of 29 other people, and there's got to be some reason behind it.
We have a study that our office made for ourselves in the court, about 15 pages that we could duplicate and give to you if you wish, maybe before you even decide on what you want to do with this bill.
Yes.
If somebody wants to read it in more detail, I didn't attempt to read it or render it because it's somewhat voluminous. But it does go into these figures that I've been talking about, and it states them and puts them down in more detail than I've been generalizing. But it's the same thing in detail.
Madam Chairman, you raise the same questions with Judge Hicks that I raised with the state printer. Where does it say in the present language of the existing statute that you can't do exactly what you want to do?
Well, one reason I used the words when I opened here, emphasize that the court has the discretion. We think maybe we have that discretion now, but it isn't clear, and we don't want to said that we're going against the legislative intent. And to specifically answer your question, on page one of the bill, on line 15, it says that the Director of General Services will do such and such, and this bill removes that provision. And that probably is the one provision that perhaps says to the Supreme Court, you will distribute your, publish and distribute your decisions through General Services and the state printer. By removing that paragraph, we think we, in effect, leave it to the complete discretion of the Supreme Court. Many of these other changes, especially the black type ones, are really only an improvement in language that we put in while we were at it.
Well, this is it.
The first stage is the meat of the bill, which takes out the General Services Department. And also later on there, at the bottom of the page, we remove the Secretary of State as having an obligation.
Well, it sounds to me, Judge Dix, that you're basing your entire case for the, for this bill on the two words on line 15, which say shall cause. And politely, if I know these things at all, it doesn't say you've got to do the printing yourself either in your building or in any building there. That just means you order when you cause.
Well, except that it says Department of Services shall cause rather than the Supreme Court.
Okay. We have a General Purchasing Department, too. And that's under the General Services. They can order it for you. I think the term is quite well taken. I don't think you made a case for the bill. I don't know what you can't do, what you want to do already.
I didn't like that kind of thing.
I wouldn't want to.
I'm certainly not sympathetic. I like to see the lawyers get the cheapest possible volume of good quality.
Well, we're afraid that if we attempted to do it different than we are, that we simply run into arguments from other departments and other persons that you're not following the law. The law says this has to be done by General Services and state printer. And part of that is the fact, Mr. Chamberlain said, it's always been done that way. And that does emphasize that perhaps that was the legislative intent originally, and that the court shouldn't be trying to do something until the legislature's had a chance to say whether they want to change the intent. I think the feeling is that that was the intent originally, and there has been no change in that intent in the meantime, that the printer will publish the Supreme Court report.
I think
we might be using technical language if we decided on
that. When you had this matter before Ways and Means, did they say, you said that they reserved judgment after the first year. In other words, they cut your budget, and you had to go back to it for the second year of printing. Did they say that they would not give you any authority unless this bill was passed? Do it any differently?
No, they said they felt we should get out of the publishing business, and they were going to take the money out of this budget. But they also put a note in, and naturally, if the legislature didn't pass this bill, which they were aware of, and that we had to go on as we were, or if the Supreme Court decided that it was better to continue as we were, then we would go to the emergency board and ask for sufficient money to publish as we had to do.
Okay.
Senator Cook.
Why is it they want to get the state out of the business of publishing? Is there an argument that saves money, or what's the point of it all?
Partly to save money, and partly, and the main reason that I'm personally more interested in is to increase the efficiency of getting the cases to the attorneys, many of whom do rely on Oregon reports and probably will from tradition themselves. And as I go here and there around the state, the attorneys especially, and judges too, are asking, why don't you get those volumes out?
Testimony was that the cost is approximately equal for West advanced sheets and bound volumes as for Oregon advanced sheets and bound volumes.
The
testimony
consumer
has been that Oregon is losing money on advanced sheets.
Of course, Ways and Means cut our budget $66,000 because they felt that our budget would save $66,000 if we bought books from West Publishing instead of publishing them ourselves.
I can't see how that should be. I don't see why it should cost less money to employ a private concern and give them a profit on the operation on top of all the materials and so on. If we have the facilities for doing that and are able to do it without providing for a profit, how can it be possible for someone else to do it cheaper?
What's wrong with your philosophy of government?
Well, it might prove one or two things. It may be that we don't have, I'm not saying this, but it sounds like someone's saying that our printing services department isn't operating the way it ought to be.
Well, for one thing, and the printer can answer this a lot better than I could, but they're doing it with, as I guess they call it, hot type. He's not a lawyer, I'm not a printer. But they have to take all this type and store it, and then they have to go over it, and after we make a change in the band sheet, it's a laborious task for him to fit in the head notes. And this all takes time and employee time and space. The Secretary of State is storing 35,000 volumes. There's a lot of money tied up in his storage room and the inventory he's holding. We have an editor who, full-time, that's all she does, is working these reports so we can save some money there. And as I testified earlier, I think the reason that the large printing firm can do it cheaper than the state of Oregon, even though they're making a profit, is simply the tremendous volume they have in producing books for every state in the union, and they just do it more efficiently.
Well, I wonder, you know, you're talking about greater speed in getting out opinions, but it seems to me that I have a Pacific Reporter in my office. I do get the advantages at home, but it seems to me that the Pacific Reporter is behind the Oregon Advantage.
They are about 2 weeks.
About 2 weeks behind. Now, what makes you think they're going to be any faster? They're actually going to slow down the distribution to the lawyers instead of speeding it up.
The advance sheets would be received about 2 weeks later. However, they would have the complete head notes. The bound volumes are the ones we're talking about. They're coming out from West in about 4 months. Ours are coming out in 12 to 17 months after.
12 to 17 months.
17 was a short time ago. The last one has come out in 12 months. We think the next one will be out in 12 months. And we think we can stay within 12 to 14 months, but we don't think we can do much better.
Senator Ivers.
Of course, I don't know whether we can really prove whether West could do it any cheaper or not, but I do have some concern about sending our business out of state rather than employing our own local people who are helping to provide the tax money to fund the court system. But I think really what we should be looking at, and it wouldn't be within the purview of this committee, sooner or later someone's going to have to look at the whole picture of the session laws, the bills, and put all this on computer, and then we could really give instant service almost. And I don't think passing this bill is really the answer, that someone should look at the complete picture for the legislature as well as the court.
Madam Chair.
Senator Cook.
Are we going to hear from the printer?
We have heard from
the printer.
Here I come.
Just a minute, please.
Another concern my office has is the problem we're having now with cost and storage and mailing is getting worse because the court, or every year they're putting out more and more decisions, and the volume is becoming more difficult for amateurs to handle.
Yes.
And for instance, mailing out the advance sheets, the way we're set up in my office, a couple secretaries and my accountant has to spend about one afternoon and sometimes almost a day a week away from their desk running mail room procedures and dragging these bundles of advance sheets down the hall. And none of them like doing it because this isn't what they're hired to do. Yet, it really isn't expected to hire labor to do that sort of thing. We think maybe we could combine with the Department of Revenue. We have talked to them about that. Maybe they could mail them out for us. But it just doesn't fit into the Supreme Court operation, and it's getting worse as the volume increases.
Further questions? Well, I wish you would give us the report, Judge Hicks.
I will. I'll give you a brief
at the present time, I don't feel, as the committee feels, that you're pointing out a reason for us to pass the bill. If you have further information, I wish you could get it to us.
All right. Well, thank you.
Is it Ted Stayworth?
Yes.
Madam Chairman, members of the committee, I have here 9 copies of the viewpoint of a printer. If you'd like to have a copy of it. I didn't intend to deviate from my
expert.
Would you
state
your name?
My name is Ted Fair.
And your position?
I've been associated with the printing industry as an active working member affiliated with the local union which I retired as a printer, and have a continuous affiliation with the ITU in several states for over 40 years. I am now speaking as a member of the Oregon Typographical Conference, and for every other person who works in the printing business, not necessarily whether they're union or not. There's 5,000 people who work in the printing business in Oregon, and only 800 of them are union. I heard two words with this last witness which interested me very much. One of them, he mentioned the word study. I thoroughly agree with that because I think that a lack of study has been done on the people who introduced this bill. He couldn't come up with an alternative. He said he needed time for a year or so to study the alternative of having state printing done by an Idaho printer. Most printers working in Oregon, all they're asking for is a share, a fair chance to do printing for the state of Oregon. The West Publishing Company in Idaho is a, in our terms, is a cut-rate printing establishment. It has 11 state clientele. It can naturally lay down a volume in Oregon cheaper than our state printing plant can. And that's not any criteria of criticism of the state printing plant, because I think that your printing plant on Ferry Street, from the viewpoint of a working printer, is doing a magnificent job under the crowded conditions that they're not working in. I don't wish to get into the argument of whether or not private industry can do a better job than a state printing plant, because it's been going on for 50 years. But I do say that the state printing plant has doing the work that's being done in Oregon for the state of Oregon is doing an incredible job and under the conditions, and I do believe that it should be, they should be allowed to continue. Now, economically, I dug out all the facts I could dig out. I'm not a paid lobbyist. I'm here on my own time at my own expense. But I couldn't come up with any information that would offset the economical aspects of this bill. They say they want to say it'll cost them $66,000 here, or if they dislocate 9 employees at $8,400 here, that's already $80,000 that the state of Oregon has lost right there. So economically, I think the sums of money are so small that they don't have any justification in bringing a bill for this one specific purpose on an economical basis. They can't. What we're concerned about as printers and private industry is that, and we have seen it happen in other states, and I have been a part of it in other states, this is the first crack in the door which will allow one specific segment of the Oregon state government to be able to direct their printing any place they want it to go. They can get it done in Idaho or California, the cut rate print shop in California, and show printers in Oregon how to work. Not only union printers, but any kind of a printer. Therefore, we say that if the point has arrived at where the volumes cost the lawyers and the judges so much more than by having it done in Oregon, and by shipping it to Idaho to the West Publishing Company and getting it done at a cheaper rate, then the study is not whether we should send it to Idaho, but the study should be carried on in our own state printing plant. Now, one of the statements that the state printer made to me when I visited him in his office was that at present the volumes print all the facts and all the opinions on everything that the judge that sits on the case wants to have printed in that volume. During the course of our conversation, I did hear him indicate that if you wanted to go for the economical end of it, there's no reason in the world why the lawyers in 11 states should be able to pick up a volume printed in Oregon or in Idaho and read all the facts about every case that was passed upon. If they want the opinions, then give them the opinions. If you want, for economical purposes, you want to get that book down to where you can buy it, then cut out the facts and give them the opinion. That would be one point in the favor of having manuals done in the state of Oregon with opinions only. I do know that I sat as a listener on Bill 611, which of course is a bill that phased out the two university printing plants. And of course Oregon right now is at the same position a lot of other states have been. They've got to make up their mind whether they're going to go into the printing business 100% modern printing with computers and do printing in the cheapest way possible. I'm not sitting here telling you that we're doing that as a printer. I'm doing the best work possible because we don't have the equipment to do it. And if you want that equipment, you got to spend $1 million for it, and you have to go and move your plant from Ferry Street into a great big brand new building and get all your computer equipment, all your cold type machinery to produce a paper or produce a book, and we could compete with the person in Idaho that's doing it, do it at below poverty wages. In other words, I'd like to have you understand that the West Publishing Company in Idaho is a cut rate plant, and if they want to cut rate, do cut rate work for the state of Idaho, that's fine. I have no objection, but I don't think that they should be able to ship their product into Oregon and undermine an Oregon printer who is living here at Bain & Stafford.
Yeah. Yeah.
I think is that if the consensus of every person that works in the state of Oregon is going to, on a steady basis, printer or not, that all we're asking for is if there is a necessity for printing to be done for the state of Oregon, then we ask printers and working for the state printing plant or in private industry to be allowed their fair share. And we cannot compete with a person that's set up in a shop in Idaho because it has such an 11-state clientele and has introduced all their new methods and pays substandard wages. We just can't compete.
Questions of Mr. Fay?
Yeah, yeah.
Senator Cook.
Now, is it your view that the reason why we're having problems in Oregon is because the equipment has been allowed to become obsolete?
Yes, sir.
And of course, that applies not only to law rules, but everything else.
Everything else. Recently, the Capital Journal plant changed over to coal type, and they magnanimously gave a lot of their equipment to Oregon State College. It was obviously 50 years old to begin with, but yet the state of Oregon thought it was necessary that they take this and take it down and spend X number of dollars to renovate it and put it back into production. They're doing a fine job with it, as good as they can, but you can't compete with hot metal equipment and outdated methods of producing a piece of printed matter when they can take a camera and a computer and do it in half the time. Now, Oregon has to make the decision whether they're going to go for that or not. They do. Pardon?
Are the total, what part of the total printing operation, if you know, I'm sorry, I wasn't here when the state printer was here, I presume you may have known, would this particular publication involve of these?
Of these two books?
Yes.
Well, when I visited him and talked to him for an hour in his office, I stated in my written testimony that he couldn't give me any facts and figures that would show any justification to this bill in the first place, because he's only talking about $66,000 in the overall publication, 600 books.
Total?
600 books or so. Now, he also states that the last witness also stated that it takes X number of months to get a book back from the state printing plant in Oregon, and it takes a third of that, or maybe a fifth of that, to get it back from Idaho.
Why is that?
Because they're using the latest modern methods of printing, and the Oregon hasn't got to that point yet. But we contend that that's no reason to dislocate Ader. He said six jobs. The state printer said six jobs, but I believe there's more than that. I believe that 9 or 10 people will be dislocated over there, and that's only the very first crack.
How many persons are employed in the Oregon state printing operation?
Well, I couldn't speak for the bookbinders or the related craft, but we have, during the legislature, we have about 25 printers. And when the legislature goes away, probably 10 or 12 of those will be let out. But those are people that come especially from the legislature. Now, I'm talking about bookbinders and everybody else that would be laid off if this amount of printing was suddenly taken out of the state printing plant and allowed to go to Idaho.
How many people do we have in the entire printing operation?
In the state printing plant?
Yeah.
I think we have over 300 employees. All together.
Good questions of Mr. Thayer.
Yeah.
Thank you, Mr. Thayer. I would tell you that we have 20 more witnesses here within the next hour. All the senators have to be at another meeting at 3 o'clock. And I would request that you not be repetitive in your testimony. Mr. Brummer?
Senator Brown, many members. I am Mr. Brummer from the Kearney Pressman's Union, Local 43 from Portland. And of course, it's pretty obvious that I have an interest in this particular bill, which we oppose. And for several reasons, I was interested in listening to the comments the previous gentleman giving his testimony here for the committee. Unfortunately, I'm not as well versed on this particular West Publishing Company. In fact, I'm not sure where it's located. I've heard Idaho and I've heard Minnesota. I know it's not in the state of Oregon. And when we talk about sending work, which is paid for by the tax dollars of the people of Oregon, out of state, certainly we all agree that there's some services we have to go out of state for. But we have an established printing plant and general services in the state of Oregon, number one. We have people employed there that are working under union conditions, union scales. And we're talking about at least 10 people in that fight alone being displaced. Now the bindery, in this particular plant are not equipped to handle this type of binding. This is what we call hard cover binding. It has to be dropped out to a private slip binder. We're talking about 8 or 10 people in that particular binder that could be displaced. To give you a set of example of this, now this is just reverse. I'm going to use reverse this, and I'll leave this with you. But I want you to view this particular chart, and this comes from the U.S. Chamber of Commerce, 1950 to 60. And it explains exactly what 100 factory workers brought into the state and what services they are required and how many additional people are needed to give the service to these 100 little people. Now, certainly displacing jobs or people from their jobs, it isn't going to help our state. And of course, for those reasons, I am very much opposed, whether it be union or non-union plants or people, very much concerned about the fact that this is being done out of state. We have the adequate equipment in the state printing plant. We all recognize it has to be updated. We also know that there are modern plants around the state that could handle this particular work. No question about it. I know they could be competitive with West Publishing Company if this were to pass. We are aware of that. There's a graphic arts center in the city of Portland. There's Daily Journal of Commerce, and go on and on, Norwest Publishing Company, which are equipped to handle this type of printing and have the bindery equipment. But to go out of state, to take our tax dollars out of state, to have this type of thing done out of state, just for the mere purpose of saving a group of people over here some dollars when they have to buy these volumes, I think it's totally unfair. At least that's my personal opinion. And I'll leave this with you as a matter of record. I want you to understand that this little chart is actually reverse of what I'm talking about. If we lose 100 people, it could affect us just the opposite way.
Questions for Mr. Brummer.
Chairman.
Senator Ivers.
If the bill were so amended so that the printing had to be done within the state of Oregon, then you'd have no objection to the rest of the bill.
Well, I think there is something along this line. I think about 1966 to 67, the state engaged Mr. Cliff Parson to make a study of the whole printing problems within the state structure. And he made certain recommendations to the Ways and Means Committee, or whoever it was, in 1967 or 68, I believe this was. I think it would behoove this committee to get a copy of that. I think it's available to John Chamberlain. I think he has a copy of it. And I think this would be very helpful to you in coming to a conclusion.
If it were the bill restricted so that the printing had to be done in the state of Oregon, would you object to the rest of the bill? Or maybe I don't want to.
I don't think I'd oppose, because I'm talking about the dollar staying within the state. That's primarily my argument.
Fine. Further questions, Senator Cook.
What position is it you hold with?
I'm the secretary of the Printing Pressman's Union, Local 43 of Portland.
Other questions?
Oh, no, I want to.
Okay, he is not all he's there.
Yes, further questions?
Yes. Now, one of the things, of course, we're all concerned about employment in Oregon, but I don't think that's what's going to pass or defeat this bill, personally.
Sure.
What I would like to know, and do you have an opinion as to whether or not you believe that the state of Oregon, if it had the right kind of equipment, could provide this legal service, this printing service, as well as other printing services, at as low a cost as an out-of-state printer such as a West Publishing Company?
Well, let me first say this to that question, if I may, sir. First of all, I don't know what type of equipment West Publishing Company has, because I haven't made the study.
Let's assume they have modern equipment.
Let's assume, but I have information from reliable source that they are not equipped totally with modern equipment. We're talking about coal type operations.
My question really isn't West. Can we, in this state, with a reasonable amount of investment in printing equipment, print things as cheaply from the standpoint of the taxpayers of Oregon as we could do if it were a job let out to private concerns?
Of course, Senator Cook, I have to segmentize here, because first of all, we're talking about composition, which is a major cost of any printing. That's a major cost, setting the type. Now, there's various methods of setting that type. In the state printing department, you have hot metal, linotype. I'm sure you've heard that many times, linotype machines. This is the method they're using in the state printing department at this time, in the general services. They have modern offset, sheet-fed offset presses in the state printing company that run in excess of 8,000 impressions an hour. It's not the presses that are antiquated. It's the antiquated methods of setting the type. And that's where the cost factor lies. in the state printing department at this point, if there is a cost factor, because we're not certain, I haven't established, and you certainly haven't, whether West Publishing Company have these modern facilities, the cold type, the IBM, these various cold types, where you feed in, a man sits and punches tape, and he feeds it in, and they make corrections on that tape. And the purpose, and I talked to Mr. Warren Deal, who I have to work with the negotiations, and I've known him for years, he's been a president of the printing industry of America, and I asked him, I said, Mr. Deal, I said, do you, in your opinion, feel that we could increase or cut the time down on modernizing the composing end of this thing? And he said, well, in his opinion, it would, the cost could be prohibited. It would have to be over a period of time making a conversion, number one. Number two, would it really answer the purpose? Because as was stated here earlier, there has to be corrections. Now, how do you get the corrections fed into your computer? Then you have to make a complete new printout again. Whereas with hot metals, the type is standing, they make a line or two of correction or addition, whatever, and they revamp the pages and pull another repro proof and shoot it. And make a film, and from there it goes lithographic plate. I'm getting into the technical aspect of this thing now.
Wait, are you saying that because of the small quantities of this particular item involved, that it might be more economical to use the present hot type setup than the other?
I think there has to be a point in time where you're going to, the state is going to be faced, like any man at business has to be faced with the fact that you are going to have to modernize equipment. I think that we haven't really watched the state problem, the General Services print shop. I don't think we've really watched it close enough to see, well, and the money hasn't been appropriated. I think this can be done over a period of years. I think you can bring that up to date, particularly
well,
in the
committee
type
doesn't
area.
Have the authority I know
you
to
don't.
Do that.
Well,
there's
right there's
no,
my question was put to me.
I don't know if I differ with you, Madam Chairman.
I hope I answered your question.
Yes, but I am interested. I think that really this is a part of the bigger problem.
Right.
And that is, before I would want to vote for this bill, I'd like to have some good technical advice as to whether or not our problem is that we have obsolete equipment rather than something else. And if we have obsolete equipment, that's not just a problem with the advanced seats of the Court of Appeals, it's a problem with the whole printing operation
right.
of the state.
But this is why I mentioned
further this. Questions, Senator?
Did I?
No, that's all I have.
Senator
all right, Brumman. Thank you. Mr. Lovett?
My name is Jim Lovett. I'm an employee of the Oregon printing industry, which is the management association. We're opposed to the bill. We're primarily opposed to the bill because we don't like to see the printers in Oregon. We don't like to see any job that's presently produced in Oregon go out of state. We do think that if this particular bill is passed and the court has their say, they will send this job to the West Publishing Company. And Oregon printers will lose. So we wish to go on record as being opposing the bill.
Thank you, sir.
Senator Hoyt. Was your principals and people you work for support a proposal to modernize the state plant instead of sabotaging the general operations so that it really can't be efficient? Now, I say categorically that that's been the position of the printing industry for the last 40 years in Oregon. Probably longer, but I know for sure for 40 years. Would your people support producing the kind of a plant that could serve the state of Oregon, the bureaucracy, if you will, the legislature, to have the kind of a plant that could do these things properly?
The Oregon printing industry feels that because they're taxpayers, they do not feel that it's necessary to have a state printing plant competing with them. We're in favor of a state printing plant to do the job that they do best. But we do feel that as a private industry, that your tax dollar and my tax dollar should be spent in the plants that are paying the tax dollar. Wherever possible, there's no reason in the world why private industry can't compete very, very favorably with the state. I don't believe that private industry in Oregon, I don't believe that the people who work in the private printing industry in Oregon take advantage of the state in any way, shape, or form.
Good question. Thank you, Mr. Lovett. Mr. Capsule, I'm not sure I'm reading this correctly.
That's my name. Jim Katsoulis. I am presently employed as Secretary Treasurer for the
Rapid Arts International Union, Bookbinders Subdivision in Portland, Oregon. Of course, I am very much opposed to that, because I feel that it circumvents laws which are already on the statutes regarding this, that it be done, that the work be done at a competitive price, that is competitive with prices, wages, and conditions here in Oregon. And for the last several years, I've witnessed the deterioration of the bookbinding industry in the state, simply because there's so much work already gone out of the state. All the yearbooks are going out of the state now. There's a college, high school, everything is going out. And it's just impossible for these people, the businesses, to expand and create more jobs unless they have the volume of work or the incentive there to do it. And I just recognize Bill 443 to be very detrimental to the industry and to the working people in the state.
Thank you, sir. Questions for Mr. Katsuba? Thank you very much. We turn to Senate Bill 408.
Who's passed this out once?
There's been a request to the chair to reconsider Senate Bill 408. If there's any objection, we will not reconsider it. Is there?
Well, the chair has a valid reason. I'll vote with her. I just the request
simply.
Itself, the two of us.
The chair simply has a request.
Sorry, I request.
I'm going to do this for
you. You're going to do this for
I don't have any objection.
If there's any objection, all right, we will reconsider 408. Does anybody wish to make a motion on it?
I move past the floor with a due pass recommendation, Madam Chair.
Senator Keith Burns moved that Senate Bill 408 pass to the floor with a due pass recommendation. I don't believe there are any amendments to it.
What did we do? As amended, there was a comma for the line.
Oh,
C. After
right.
Word.
As amended.
Is that why we reconsider it?
Yeah.
Pass it out,
so you
want to
put the comma in now?
Put
the comma
in.
Yeah.
We
need a new
printing plan. Is there discussion of 408?
I'm not sure the Senator Cook was here when we
took I don't know when they were talking about the comma.
I thought
we were
going to
have a memorandum.
We have a memorandum. The purpose of this is so that when these lands are filled, that they have to compensate the municipality for the extension of any storm outfalls that have to be extended out, or if there's any water mains or sewer mains where the fill comes in, that they destroy them and they have to compensate.
I remember I was here when we had the bill.
That's the purpose.
The motion is pass out 408. Further discussion. Clerk, call the roll.
Senator Cooper.
Aye.
Senator Cook.
Aye.
Senator Ivers.
Aye.
Senator Boyce.
Aye.
Senator Smith.
Aye.
Assigned to Senator Keith Burns. Senate Bill 379, Herb Titus.
In the interest of saving time in the committee, my statement is addressed not only to 379 but also to 385. The bills are different, but they are closely related. And I also have with me statements of Fred Merrill on behalf of the American Civil Liberties Union. He asked me if I might present them to you, and I'm going to present them in writing on his behalf for the record.
Thank you.
My name is Herbert Titus. I'm a professor at the University of Oregon Law School and an active member of the Oregon State Bar. For the record, I'm not making a statement today on behalf of the university, the State Board of Higher Education, or the State Bar, but rather I'm here appearing on behalf of myself, several inmates at the Oregon State Penitentiary, and I'm not retained by those inmates here either. I have a written statement. I'll pass that around too, and as I indicated, my statement is addressed not only to 379 but also to 385, And if your pleasure is that I simply summarize my remarks on both bills, then you don't have to call me back for 385.
I think that would be very convenient if you would do so.
Now, on both of these bills, if you might look at section 1 of each bill, you find that the first section...
385, we're looking at both...
At both 385 and 379, you'll find that sections 1 in both bills are the same. And that section 1 is addressed to one problem, which we see with respect to the state Board of Parole and Probation, and that is that it is completely exempt from the Administrative Procedures Act. And both 379 and 385 are designed to eliminate the exemption from the rulemaking provisions of the Administrative Procedures Act. And then to exempt only partially the Board of Parole and Probation's contested case exemption.
Now you're talking the 379?
Both 379 and 385. If you look at section 1, subsection 1, line 10, and I believe it's line 10 and 379 and line 9 of 385, you see the present language of the Administrative Procedure Act exempting the State Board of Parole and Probation entirely from the APA. And the substituted language, which gives only a partial exemption to the State Board, is in the bold type, subsection 4, which is on line 19 of 379, or line 18 of 385. That essentially exempts the State Board of Parole and Probation from the contested case provisions with respect to the granting or denying applications for parole, leaving the revocation of parole once granted subject to the contested case provisions of the Administrative Procedures Act. Now, Senate Bill 379 is designed to set forth additional procedures as well as some modifications to the Administrative Procedures Act insofar as it applies to revoking parole. That's what 379 does. 385 sets up alternative procedures governing the granting or denying parole in the at first. So you see the relationship here is that 379 is a parole revocation bill, and 385 is a bill governing the granting or denying parole in the first instance. Now, these bills are introduced independently. You could pass one and not the other. They do not need to go hand in glove, although they certainly mesh with each other. They are not inconsistent. But nonetheless, they need not be looked at as two bills that must be passed, if at all. One or the other could be. Now, I'm not going to address myself to the specifics of 379. Vic Pagel from the Marion Polk Legal Aid is prepared to address himself to the specific features of 379. I'm simply trying to... I would only limit my comments to the fact that 379... is almost, although not quite, parallel with the requirements that are laid down in the Morrissey case, which was passed by decided by the United States Supreme Court just this last June 1972, which I discuss on page 3 and 4 of my written remarks to show the parallels between 379 and the requirements as laid down in the due process clause by the Supreme Court. Now, of course, one significant difference is that 379 provides right to counsel, whereas the Supreme Court in the Morrissey case declined to rule on that issue. They didn't rule that you couldn't have counsel. They declined to rule on whether the due process clause required counsel. But as I indicated to you, I would limit my remarks on 379 to those contained in my written remarks, especially pages 3 and 4, and defer to Mr. Pagel's more detailed statement on that. Now, as to 385, which you recall is the one that is addressed to the granting and denying of parole, essentially what is attempted there is to lay down some legislative guidelines on whether a person is going to be considered for parole. As it now stands, whether a person is considered for parole or not is within the discretion of the parole board. We think there ought to be some guidelines with respect to whether someone is considered for parole. And the guidelines that we set forth are guidelines which would guarantee consideration after 6 months after incarceration, and then annually thereafter. Now, I know that there is going to be some opposition to this bill on the grounds that, well, that's going to cost a lot of money, and the parole board is simply physically unable to do that. But I don't think that that particular guarantee should be isolated from other provisions in the bill, which I think are likely to reduce substantially the numbers of cases that are going to be considered, because the other part of the bill requires the board to state in specific terms why a particular person is denied.
If you would refer to the bill number and the page and the line.
I'm sorry. The time, that is, the guarantee of a hearing, is in Section 2, Subsection 1, and it begins on line 12 of 385. So I'm now talking about 385 and not 379. I'm sorry, I should have indicated that I'd switched gears. My comments on 379 were limited to the parallels between that and the Morrissey case, and Mr. Pagel will continue to talk about in more detail. And on 385, there is Section 2, Subsection 1, which guarantees periodic review and consideration by the State Board of Parole and Probation. As I indicated to you, I felt that some question about whether it's possible and whether it would be feasible financially to do that is linked, I think, in part, to Subsection 2, 3, 4, and especially Section 3 over on page 4, beginning with line 6 and line 13. That is, the need for that kind of periodic review is going to be largely determined by the statements of the parole board of the reasons why someone is not entitled to parole at that particular time. Obviously, if the reason is declared and stated, and if through the passage of time the situation has not changed sufficiently, then there would hardly be any need for another hearing with respect to that kind of an issue. But basically what
Send us where?
Yes.
Are you contending that subsection 2 of this bill will actually provide that the present method will be no more expensive when you allow an inmate to ask for a hearing, ask witnesses to be present, ask counsel to represent him?
No.
Is it going to be less expensive and less time-consuming?
No, I didn't intend to indicate to you that it would be less expensive or less time-consuming. I'm just simply trying to say that when one attempts to assess how much more time and how much more expensive it might be, one should not assume that it's going to mean that they were going to have a full dress hearing every year with respect to every case. It's very likely, in light of subsection 2, that some additional time and perhaps additional monies are going to be spent with respect to the cases because of these additional requirements. But let me point out with respect to that, that already the parole board does have personal interviews with potential parolees. They also keep records on tape of what happens. And it could, as a matter of fact, mean more money. It might not, depending upon how matters might be resolved prior to these hearings. That is, there might be a reduction in time in terms of prior preparation. If you look at subsection 3, for example, what we do with subsection 3 is to try to get information to the prospective parolee before the hearing in view of the fact that the person may then be able to say, oh, I know what the issues are here. It's over this or it's over that, prior to the hearing itself, hoping that by giving the person an opportunity before the interview to know what the issues might be, that that would reduce, consequently, the time of the interview itself. Now, obviously, I can't sit here and say it's going to cost less money and involve less time.
No, I don't think so.
But I do believe that one ought to be skeptical about how much more it's going to cost. Now, let me say one other thing about that, and that, again, gets back to a point that I've made before, and that's the question of whether or not by saving time at the initial stage, you might end up costing more money and involving more time at the subsequent stage. That is, this bill, 385, as is 379, is designed to make the administrative process work better in order to avoid costs that are later going to be incurred through habeas corpus and proceedings of that kind. That's one of the reasons why we think the Administrative Procedures Act is most fitting to deal with these problems, because we think that it may end up costing the state less, because you have to look at the parole process not just in terms of what the parole board does, but what happens when someone goes to court contesting the legality or the decision made by the parole board. So it may be that if you look at the bill as a whole, what you might be paying here would be offset by what savings there might be at the other end, because we propose a cheaper judicial review process. Just as an example, is under the Administrative Procedures Act, in order to review what the parole board would do under either 379 or under the alternate procedures for judicial review under 385, which is in Section 6, it would not require any particular parole board member to be in present at the particular judicial review, whereas under habeas corpus, they may be subpoenaed and sit down there for a whole day waiting for a determination under a habeas corpus, which certainly is costing the state money and would detract from the parole board's business. So I think you have to look at the bill in the totality in order to assess how much the cost factor is here.
Questions of Mr. Titus. Mr. Titus has spoken on both 379 and 385 of the question.
Oh, Madam Chairman.
Senator Smith.
I don't know what percentage of the inmates that either stand or the correctional institution are classified as indigent. I expect it's a very high percentage. This kind of representation then will be furnished at cost to the state on these two various hearings. They come up each year. The question I want to ask you is how many habeas corpus appeals are there made to decisions of the parole board at the present time?
Well, I don't think there are very many, but I think...
Why?
Well, I think the reason for that is twofold. One, the persons who have not won their case before the parole board have not considered judicial review. They've had difficulty in the past getting any court to listen to them. But I think in light of the Morrissey case that was decided in June 1972, you're going to see a great number, an increase in habeas corpus reviews of the parole board's work. I don't know what the figures are on that particular thing, but I think you're going to see an increase. I think the other thing is that lawyers are now much more prepared to deal with these matters and raise them under habeas corpus. So I think that you can pretty much assured that there are going to be additional habeas corpus attacks on both the revocation process, perhaps less on the revocation because of the Morrissey case, but more so on the at the release stage. Mm-hmm. Now let me make one other comment about the right to counsel. I think we've talked about this before the committee, and that's in conjunction with Senate Bill 376, and I'm not so sure that it's so clear that if counsel is not provided, if counsel is allowed at the administrative hearing stage, that the state would have to pay for it. That's a matter which was clearly left open in the Morrissey case by the Supreme Court. And moreover, even if counsel is required under due process, there's no indication that the Equal Protection Clause would require the state to pay for it for those who are unable to pay. Well, they either would have to obtain money themselves, they might obtain the services of a legal aid society, or they might find the services of outfits such as the ACLU and other outfits which would provide counsel free of charge. But I don't think you should assume that the state would have to pay for counsel in either of these cases. Well, I think that the United States Supreme Court has indicated that in matters civil, civil matters are going to be treated differently from criminal, and these matters here have been designated as civil matters. There's a recent ruling on requiring a filing fee in the state, for example, with the United States Supreme Court, very close decision, 5-4, said that the Equal Protection Clause does not require the waiver of filing fees in a civil action.
Further questions, Mr. Carter. Thank you, Mr. Patrick.
Thank you very much.
I just want to call to your attention that, as far as I know, according to the schedule on our desk downstairs, Senate Bill 80 is coming up on Wednesday, the printed endorsed bill could be out tomorrow. I sent you notes about what sections you were assigned. I know that some of you voted against the bill. Sections you've been assigned, you did not vote against. But if anybody has any objection, I'd like to know about it before Wednesday. On 379, is it Mr. Padgell?
My name is Victor Pagel. I'm director of Marion Polk Legal Aid Service here in Salem. About 10 days ago, I brought over to your office, Senator Brown's, some written comments. I hope that if you don't have them now, I'll see that the committee gets them later. I'll make more copies. Mr. Titus has already referred to the coverage of the APA with respect to the parole board. I'd like to confine my remarks then to the contested case aspect, and that's the parole revocation process. Under Morrissey versus Brewer, the process is required, and if the APA were required with respect to the parole board and parole revocation process, then Morrissey versus Brewer would indeed be satisfied. I cannot foresee of any possible way that the APA procedures would be inadequate. And if you don't have, I guess you don't have my written comments now, I'll be sure and get more copies over here, but I set those out. I compare the requirements of Morrissey to specific sections in the APA to show you how they would be covered. I won't dwell on that any longer. Now, Morrissey required a two-stage hearing process. One is a preliminary hearing near the place of the alleged parole violation to determine whether there is probable cause to believe the parolee violated conditions of parole. Now, this proceeding would not come under the APA because the APA covers contested cases which are concerned with final orders, and the order resulting from the preliminary hearing would not be considered a final order. And this is provided for in Senate Bill 379, Sections 4, 5, and 6. The procedures for that preliminary hearing are specifically set out because the APA would not actually apply.
Maybe for it to be intelligent to us, you should tell us what the procedures are now.
What the parole board does now?
Yeah.
It's my understanding that since the Morrissey case last June, that the parole board, given to the best extent, to the extent it possibly can, given its resources, does provide a preliminary hearing. Exactly what happens at the preliminary hearing, perhaps the parole board members could explain. And it's my understanding also that if the parolee desires, there is a subsequent revocation hearing at a later date, if there is indeed probable cause to believe that the parolee violated conditions of parole. Now, exactly what is happening in these two hearings? My office has represented three parolees at the revocation hearing, not at the preliminary hearing. And one of those now is in litigation, and I probably shouldn't discuss it, but there are some procedural problems that are now being litigated arising out of one of those three hearings at my office. Those problems would not be problems if Senate Bill 379 were adopted. If the procedures in 379 and the APA coverage were adopted, those kinds of problems that are now being litigated, and I'm quite sure there will be more, whether my office or some other office handles them. The revocation hearing then, the procedures for the revocation hearing are not spelled out in 379 because the APA applies. We simply refer to the APA with respect to the usual kinds of procedures that take place in any agency proceeding. There are some special provisions, however, that are in 379. For instance, in Section 8, we felt that it was most important that the parolee be given notice in writing of all of the rights that he will have at both the hearings. Section 8 is with respect to the revocation hearing. And then earlier in the bill, section 4, is the written notice that goes to the parolee with respect to his rights in the preliminary hearing. Ms. Titus already mentioned that the bill provides for appointment of counsel. I mentioned in my written comments that I believe, it's my opinion, that even under the present composition of the United States Supreme Court, that if and when the issue of rights to counsel for indigents is before that court will decide that due process, equal protection of the law require that a state appoint counsel at the state's expense for the indigent parolee. There are at least two United States Circuit Court of Appeals decisions so holding. One's in the Second Circuit and one's in the Fourth Circuit. That was even before Morrissey, I believe. One of them was before Morrissey, requiring appointment of counsel. But the Supreme Court specifically declined to rule on it because actually the issue wasn't before them, according to the majority. I think it's important to point out, without regard to whether or not a court is going to still require an appointment of counsel, I think this is a very crucial time in a parolee's life because, obviously, not only does he have an opportunity to show that he did not violate conditions of parole, but under Morrissey, he has to have an opportunity to show that even if he did violate conditions of parole, there are mitigating circumstances. Now, parole board can't possibly be expected to do an adequate and conscientious job of looking after the parolee's interests. The parolee can't possibly be expected to do an adequate job of preparing his case if he's confined in the penitentiary or FBI. He has a right to bring witnesses. He has a right to present letters, cross-examine. He needs an attorney or someone versed in the law to assist him in his case. Another matter is the judicial review under this bill. It's already been mentioned that it would be, I believe it's been mentioned, the judicial review under the APA would go to the Court of Appeals. And there was some discussion in the House Judiciary Committee on this bill compared to the House Bill 2110. The concern was that parolees whose parole had been revoked would not only seek judicial review in the Court of Appeals, then they'd go ahead and file a habeas corpus writ or petition. It is my opinion that a parolee recommitted for violation of parole would never have a trial on a habeas corpus petition and a habeas corpus writ on any matter that reasonably should have been raised in the Court of Appeals or under the APA judicial review. And my reason for stating this, is that under the APA, the statute says that judicial review is solely by these provisions, that's in 183.480. And in addition, the post-conviction statutes, 138.540, that say that habeas corpus or other remedies provided by law shall be allowed for parolees for alleged unlawful revocation of parole. The habeas corpus or other remedies, I think if you tie all these together, that's where I base my opinion, that I don't believe that people should fear a whole bunch of habeas corpus cases being filed even after the APA judicial review procedures have been utilized. One more point is with respect to Section 16 of Senate Bill 379. At the present time, under 144.390, a prisoner recommitted for violation of parole shall serve out his sentence and the time during which he was out on parole is not a part thereof. This is a very oppressive kind of a statute to many people. The example I gave in my written comments is, let's say a prisoner with 7-year sentence is paroled after serving 3 years, and then 3 years later he was committed for violation of parole. He would then not only have to serve the one more year, to meet his 7 years, he'd have to serve 3 additional years, that 3-year period while he was out on parole. And this amendment would simply provide that he would receive credit against his sentence for the time that he was out on parole and not in violation of rules of parole, so that when the revocation process takes place, there will have to be some kind of a finding. If parole is going to be revoked, there'll be a finding as to when he violated the provisions, and he will receive credit against the sentence for the time up until the time he violated conditions. I think that's all I have.
Questions of Mr. Tatum.
What was the division of the court on the Morrissey case?
I believe it was unanimous. The
You remember her?
Yeah, well, it was unanimous, and then a couple of...
Yeah.
And then there were a couple of concurring opinions that simply, where they simply thought they should have met the right to counsel issue head on, but the majority declined to.
Do you want to review quickly the holdings of the Morrissey case?
Sure. In fact, if you'd like, it's a two-stage process. There has to be a preliminary hearing to determine whether or not probable cause or reasonable grounds exist to believe the parolee violated conditions of parole. After that hearing, the parolee must be allowed...
This is before the parole board.
Now, this can be before either the parole board or the court specifically stated it could also be before a parole officer. The court only stated that it should not be before the person who's making the charges. You know, his specific parole officer should not be the hearing officer. So there is considerable flexibility there as to who can be the hearing officer in that case. The parolee at that hearing has to be allowed to confront and cross-examine those who are bringing charges against him, who are making the allegations. And this right is excused only if in the case of an informant situation where there's reasonable grounds to exist, the informant might be subjected to risk of harm if his identity were disclosed. There has to be a written decision stating the reasons and the decision after that preliminary hearing. The reasons for the decision and the decision. And then if it's adverse to the parolee, there is a revocation hearing. Within a reasonable time, the court stated, and they said that 2, 3, 4 months, I believe, was considered reasonable.
Before whom is that?
The parole, well, again, I believe the court assumed that would be before the parole board. And I'm sure that's what would happen in any case in Oregon. And at that hearing, again, disclosure of the evidence, right to confront and cross-examine, except for that good cause. It declined to refer to right to counsel. Will appear and present evidence. They also held that there must be some flexibility with regard to the evidence the parolee would like to present. In other words, they don't have to be confined to strict rules of evidence. Affidavits, letters could be, in some cases, sufficient and satisfactory and competent evidence in one of these hearings.
Well, there's notice and confrontation and right to hearing, but not to counsel.
Not to counsel. And then again, the right to a written statement of the facts and the reasons. And again...
And there's a preliminary hearing and there's a revocation.
Right.
Senator Ivey.
I
have
one further. The parole board could comply with all the requirements of the Morrissey case without the passage of this law, couldn't they? They want to adopt this as their standard procedure?
I think it's possible. One of the... with some exceptions. One exception would be... If there's a parolee is out of state, what about, how do you force the other states, number one, to have a preliminary hearing? Number two, when you bring the parolee back, how does he have a right to confront and cross-examine somebody in another state? Well, this is solved under the APA, because under the APA, you have a right to depositions as they're done in civil cases. And so the parolee is not denied that very crucial right of confrontation.
You have the problems that when he's out of state anyhow. What I'm saying is the parole board could provide for all the depositions and everything else if they wanted to.
I don't think they don't have the authority. They don't have subpoena power right now, I don't believe.
They could provide for depositions.
They don't have any authority to require depositions to be taken. If a willing person could participate, but the parole board has no authority to require anyone to submit to depositions. Whereas under 279, they would have that authority.
Even though the person, the witness would be out of state?
That's right.
Further questions? Here we go. Senator Smith.
It seemed to me that your statement was in conflict with Mr. Titus somewhat. Titus said that these are civil matters, provided to counsel. I think you said that you expect a ruling on this question, and therefore they would be entitled. Is that correct?
I stated that. I didn't hear Mr. Titus say what he said.
Mr. Titus was defending Bill and telling me that it wasn't going to cost anymore, saying that these matters would had it classified now civil matters, therefore it wasn't identified. The state should have to provide counsel at this time.
So, Cash, why don't you come up here to the table and maybe you can answer the question better than this to take out.
Yeah, I made the remark in response to your question on 385. I must say I wasn't as clear as I should have been. I was talking about 385. I don't believe that 385 would require payment of counsel, which is the release or the point of denying or granting parole. Revocation is a different matter.
Well, same thing with the preliminary hearing.
What? I don't think you have to worry about
that. What I'm trying to make, if you're correct, the court does rule, as you indicated they may, if they're confronted with a question head on, then I'm assuming that means the state will have to provide counsel in 385 or 379.
No. I believe it would be 379 only, and only then with respect to the revocation hearing, not the preliminary hearing.
Would you just, without divulging your case, tell us about the problems that you've encountered with the Board of Parole?
I just, really, basically, I briefly outlined it. It's an out-of-state situation. There's no authority to insist upon our right to confront and cross-examine adverse witnesses. No preliminary hearing where possibly the confrontation cross-examination could have been cured because there would have been that right at the preliminary hearing.
Has the person been expedited? You're talking about Morrissey. Morrissey applies where it happened as well as it applies. What are you saying? They're not enforcing Morrissey?
Well, this was very close after Morrissey, and probably with respect to the preliminary hearing, it would have been unfair to require any parole board to comply with Morrissey, at least on the preliminary hearing matter.
Right. Senator Ivins.
No, I think the answer is in.
Further questions? Thank you.
Thank you.
Sure. 3 o'clock.
Okay, the meeting is closed.